Hey guys, don't forget the 2023 Street Cop Training Conference, Nashville, Tennessee, April 23rd through the 28th. You do not want to miss this. So far, guest speakers, Rob O'Neill, the Navy SEAL that was responsible for killing Osama bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, U.S. Marine, Medal of Honor recipient, jumping on an IED to protect his platoon. Fox News host Tommy Lahren returns for 2023. Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff Mark Lamb, Sheriff David Clark, and more to come. You don't want to miss this event. We additionally have 20 of the country's top law enforcement educators giving you the best experience of your life. You will leave this event knowing more about your job and how to be proficient at the things you do, hands down, any other event that you'll ever attend. I personally guarantee it. Don't miss out. There's a room code at streetcop.com for our room block and room code at the Gaylord at Opry is where the event's taking place. Don't miss out on a discounted rate. The rate is from Sunday to Thursday. Put that in and find yourselves at a half-price room. Split it with a friend, but make sure you get there. You don't want to miss this event. It is going to be that good. If you trust me and you trust Street Cop, trust that you will leave there feeling like you've had an experience of a lifetime.
You trying to be a street cop?
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. Your host, founder, and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and I have with me today the legendary case law ninja himself. We have a red ninja, we have a case law ninja. One's shorter with red hair, one's taller with blonde. This is the taller with blonde one and has a southern accent, not a weird Chicago accent. But none other than Zach Miller joining me today. Zach, I miss you.
Good to see you. It's been a while. Glad to be back.
Zach will be on the road quite a bit coming up. He's announced his retirement, and he will be coming on the road as a Street Cop instructor a lot of times a month. So it's a good possibility that his training course is going to be in your area. I would highly suggest you go to it. We get rave reviews. He does one hell of a job of explaining constitutional law, and it's just flabbergasting that we're supposed to uphold the Constitution and nobody even knows how to. Yeah. Right, you think about that. We always laugh. Him and I always talk. I was at his house, as a father-in-law's house recently in Virginia. I came to visit him for his retirement, and we were talking like, man, it's wild that nobody even knows how to protect constitutional rights.
And it's one of the things in your oath of office. It's like the first thing you say: swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. You know, it's right there. It's right front and center, and we still struggle mightily with it.
It's wild. It's and. We're doing our best to not just complain about it, but to try to get clarity out there so you guys can make appropriate calls in the field. You know, people don't realize that cops don't intentionally, for the most part, violate constitutional rights. It's not that video that came out with that girl with the guy at the walking stick. You know, I didn't.
Yeah.
Listen, it's a tough video to watch, but I'm telling you, I have compassion for her because I think about all the things that I did that I had no idea I couldn't do or I could do. So I honestly have almost no compassion for the sergeant. None. You should know better, right? That I'm going to say that right there. I don't hate the guy. He made a mistake. I get it. But I have to do say this. If you're going to wear chevrons, you should know better. If you don't want to know it, then don't wear the chevrons.
That's what the extra money is for.
Better know what you're talking about, chevron wearer and up. You better know what the law says.
Yeah.
I've seen it. I worked at three different agencies. The training's horrendous. Nobody knows what they're talking about. So when she's doing that, she's probably seen that 83 times. She's probably a rookie. You know,
and I don't think there's any malice on her part at all. No malice, just lack of understanding.
Yeah. Anywho, I have a new class that came out. It had to do a lot with homes. Still, I'm sorry, does have to do with home entry, warrantless with warrants, what kind of warrants they mean, plain view exceptions, a few different things. Jersey departs a tad from the U.S. Supreme Court in some of these decisions, but overall, the principles are the same. So I wanted to talk to Zach today and ask him a few questions about the homes. Now, in my program, I start off with showing a picture of a threshold of a front door of a home. And it says the Fourth Amendment across the threshold. There's a reason why I put it there, because I feel like a lot of decisions are made at the threshold, at the entry of the front door of the house. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's a very important part. Yeah.
Tell me about the difference between being in public, and we'll go right into U.S. v. Santana right after this, but being in public versus being in the privacy of your own home and the kind of rights that are afforded to you in the confines of your home.
Well, you certainly have no, there certainly is no area that you have a greater Fourth Amendment protection than in your home. There's definitely a hierarchy of protection. There's four constitutionally protected areas: persons, houses, papers, and effects. And the home is definitely at the top above your person. You have more of a privacy expectation in your home than you do in your actual person. And when it comes to things like arrest, a warrantless arrest in public is reason, as long as you have probable cause, a warrant is never required to make an arrest in public. But to make an arrest in a house, and it's not so much that to make the arrest you need a warrant, it's to enter the house to make the arrest where the warrant consideration comes into play. So having probable cause to make an arrest is all you need to make an arrest outside of a house. But to go into a house, even if you have PC to make an arrest, a lot of times you're going to have a warrant. And the threshold is the line between public, from public to home is that threshold. That door, that front door opening is where that line, you have to draw the line somewhere. When do you stop being in public? Once you've crossed the threshold of the house.
And what's interesting
is talked about that.
Yeah, and Santana talked about what's interesting about Santana, people don't get confused, is being in the threshold is actually different than being behind the threshold, correct?
Yes. Yeah. In the threshold is in public. You're in public view. The public can see you, hear you. You're essentially in public for Fourth Amendment purposes, arrest purposes. Yeah, but once you step back fully inside the house, you now have that full protection of being in the home.
So I think it's important to know that if you have somebody standing on their threshold, right? So if you know anything about flooring, when you transition from one room to another, there's usually a threshold. Mm-hmm. And standing on it is public. Being behind it is not.
Correct. Correct. Yeah. And you get right.
Before we go on to unpacking US v. Santana, you know, I get a question all the time and I want to see how you'd like to serve it up. And we've probably addressed this before, but shit, why not do it again, right? I mean, it can never hurt.
Sure.
I get this question a lot. Hey, my captain said that, if we see a guy a week after he commits an offense, there's nothing we can do. We'd have to go get a warrant. So the scenario is, let me try to paint this as clearly as possible. A crime has occurred, an offense has occurred. And they learn of facts. Maybe they didn't have the suspect, but they don't pull a warrant out on the guy immediately. A week later, they see the suspect for the crime. They know he committed a probable cause to arrest him. Does that probable cause diminish? And I say to people all the time, let's think about this. You have a homicide that occurs. You suspect it's the guy. You guys are waiting on results. And then all of a sudden, PC comes out a month later that this is the guy. No warrants out yet, but we know he's the guy who committed the murder. Warrants will be sought at some point. For whatever reason, they're not done yet. Are you letting that person walk away from a homicide a month, a week, 2 weeks later because you don't have a typed up warrant yet? So the Fourth Amendment question is is there a time period that elapses outside of the statute of limitations, which obviously are very relevant here? So, for example, typically, and correct me if I'm wrong, misdemeanor offenses, you have up to 364 days, about a year for the statute of limitations.
Generally speaking, yes. Generally speaking. Exceptions to that, but yes, yes.
And then for crimes, you usually have 5 to 7 to sometimes for homicides, they never have an ending statute of limitations.
Correct. Yeah, homicide typically doesn't have a statute of limitations. I don't think a lot of serious sexual assaults don't have statutory limitations or statutes of limitations, but yeah.
So why don't you help us understand this?
All right.
What can you do?
Yeah, for Fourth Amendment purposes, it's pretty straightforward. Once you have probable cause to arrest, the arrest itself does not require a warrant ever. Now, probable cause to arrest is not like probable cause to search. Probable cause to search can get stale after a point. Having probable cause to search a house for drugs today doesn't necessarily mean if I wait 2 weeks to search that, let's say I get a search warrant today to search a house for drugs, but I wait 2 weeks to execute that warrant for whatever reason. There's certainly an argument to be made that probable cause could be stale. Like I no longer have probable cause to search this house because the drugs could be gone, circumstances can change. But when it comes to an arrest, once you develop probable cause to arrest this person for a crime that's been committed, that doesn't go away. It doesn't dissipate or become less forceful of probable cause unless new facts come to light where, okay, well, maybe we've now determined this is not the right guy. But that's a rare circumstance. So probable cause to arrest doesn't get stale typically. And the Fourth Amendment does not require a warrant to make an arrest in a public case, a public place. That's what that's United States versus Watson. That was one of the things the court talked about there is that was an arrest, I think, like in a restaurant or some business or that was a warrantless arrest. And the court said in a public area, as long as you have probable cause, you don't need a warrant. It doesn't matter how long ago the offense occurred. As long as you say, like you said, it's within the statute of limitations for that offense. That's the Fourth Amendment answer. Now, some states do require you to obtain warrants to make an arrest after a certain period of time has elapsed. But that doesn't typically invoke the exclusionary rule and all the Fourth Amendment protections that go with it.
I remember a friend of mine, he was following up to an eluding or an attempted murder or something like that. And he said they had the guy, right? They knew who it was. They finally figured out who the guy was. And PC to arrest him. They call the captain and he says, now you got to go back and get a search. Got to go back and get an arrest warrant first. This is like a week after this offense occurs.
And I'm assuming this guy is not in a house somewhere, right? Like he's.
No, I think it was public. I forgot how it went. It was years ago, but I've heard this one a few times. I get people call me and say, especially guys that I know and I'm friends with. They're like, I don't know why both times it was a captain, right? Captain said, I need to go get a warrant first where we can lock him up. I'm like, I don't understand. Like, what are you guys talking about? Oh, a DV happened a week ago. We saw the guy. We didn't get a warrant then, but we have PC to arrest him for it. Do I have to go get a warrant first? The answer is no, you don't. He did the offense.
Right.
Statute of limitations isn't up. The time, don't forget, statute of limitations is interesting because you have to understand it. That time, that clock for statute of limitations begins ticking at a certain set of facts. Maybe you can unpack that a little bit too.
It's when the offense occurs is once that clock starts. So whenever the alleged assault and battery is a good example because that's typically a 1-year statute of limitations. It begins to run on the time that incident occurs. So we have 1 year or 364 days to make an arrest and initiate the prosecution process. So it runs from
time it occurs. Yeah, there are any other times when we would have the clock starts at a different time. I'm reading about this.
I don't know if it's, there may be some states that say it runs at the development of probable cause. Once you've developed probable cause, that would be, I think the minority position, but typically it runs from the time the offense occurs.
I know, for example, we have a statute in New Jersey for sexual assault, of a minor. Mm-hmm. So I don't know the actual thing. It's the criminal aggravated sexual assault. Now, what they say here is it's a 20-year statute of limitations.
Okay.
However, let's say the person goes to their therapist at 23. They were molested at 2 years old. They go to the therapist at 23. And all of a sudden, the therapist is able to drag this out. And they go, I was molested. They say that's when the clock begins at that point.
So when the crime has been discovered, that's another. So it's when the offense is occurring, or there are exceptions like that for when the crime has been discovered by the victim or something like that. So yeah, that could start the clock then 20 years down the road. Yes.
You know, it's interesting. People ask me the same question for motor vehicle violations. So they'll say, hey, I see a car, right? And I see the guy driving it and I see the offense and then he gets away. But an hour later, I see that car again. Can I stop that car? And the question I have back to them is it the same driver? And can you confirm that? Yeah, it's the same guy. Well, what do you think? The statute of limitations ran out in an hour? Most driving violations probably at a very minimum are 30 days, up to a year and plus. So like in New Jersey, for example, most of our violations for a motor vehicle, whether it's maintenance or some kind of moving violation, is 30 days. And you have stuff like driving while suspended, DWI, some kind of driving while uninsured. Those go up to like 90 days, 6 months, and a year statute of limitations from when it happened for us to prosecute.
Yeah. I mean, in some states, traffic offenses are just treated like misdemeanors. So it's easy.
I mean, like, could you imagine, like, the guy got away 2 minutes? He's like, well, he turned off into this person's driveway already. And like, he's out of the car. Can I still stop that car? Like, why do you think the whole, you know, let's call it probable cause at that point, not reasonable suspicion. You have PC to stop that car. He's gone. 2 minutes later, you discover him, but he's out of the car. What should I do? You know, it sounds crazy. And we, like, here we are 20 plus years in this game, in that ballpark, you and I both. And you got to remember, like, I remember having these questions when I was a recruit. Like, what do you do then? What do you do in this scenario? What do you do in that scenario? And nobody had the answers. It's wild, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I can tell you that statutes of limitations are not measured in minutes. I can tell you that. So, yeah, the fact it's been 2 minutes is irrelevant.
I would even say the fact that it's been even a day or 5 hours or a week.
No, you're good to go. You're good to go.
We had a job one time. I remember seeing this car, and I knew the Lord wanted me to stop this car, right? So I see the kid, and the first time I see him, I see his car. I go, look at this son of a, like, I just knew he was like sauce. There's a medial barrier. We could not get to him. Then the next, like, dude, I'm telling you, like 2 hours later on my shift, I see this kid the opposite way with the medial barrier. I'm like, come on, right? Like, something's not right here, right? I'll never forget the end of my shift. I worked midnights that time. Or maybe, I probably worked late afternoons, like a 5 p to 3 a, because I remember my partner was my friend Mitch. And we always stopped at 7-Eleven before we went in for the night. And, you know, we were just being unhealthy at 3 o'clock in the morning. I can't lie. And that dude pulled up, but a girl was driving now. Right. Wow. And I'm like, the same car. And I'm like, so I looked at him and I'm like, you know, the Lord wants us to act here. I'm like, yeah, my man. I'm like, were you driving that car earlier? He's like, no. I'm like, yeah, you were. I saw you driving a few times. You weren't your seat. Now, what it was, I didn't see him wearing a seatbelt. Mm-hmm. Ends up having a load of warrants, right? Ended up being a really good job. He had some real good warrants, because when he saw us, he was shitting his pants. Mm-hmm. Every time he saw us, he was like looking right at the police car. I'm like, God damn, look at the son of a bitch, right? So when he came back, he's like, no, I wasn't driving. I'm like, yeah, you were driving it and you weren't wearing a seat. He actually might have been pulled up without a seatbelt on. I'm like, you were driving that car. So I'm like, if he's suspended, we'll get him on that. No question about it. Maybe we'll lock him up on the suspended driving, because I definitely saw him earlier, and on two occasions. And I was second officer witness. I wasn't making that up. And he ended up popping for warrants. Mm-hmm. Good job. It was actually funny.
Yeah, right. And nothing wrong with making that arrest. Absolutely.
I'll tell you a real funny story about this kid, right? So I was like, yeah, what's your name? And he's like, Eugene. And I forget what his last name was he gave me. And I was like, so wait a second. Where do you live? He tells me like two towns over. I go, what are your parents' names that you live with? And he gives me a different last name. And I'm like, so tell me, Eugene, how do you have a different last name than your parents? How is that possible? Because I'm pulling up the address on the Google, right? I'm like, And he like looks at me and he's like, dude, I swear to God, he puts his act and he's like, I want to talk about it, bro. And I'm like, what's the matter, bro? Right? So outside of it, it's actually on video. We have the video of it. I'm like, what's the matter, man? You can tell me. And he's like, I don't want to tell a lot of people this, but I was adopted. It's like embarrassing. He's like, so I don't really know my parents. And I'm like, all right, cool. I'm like, but the new people you live with, their last name is so-and-so. And he's like, yeah. I go back to the car. My partner's in there. I go, run this name with that last name and this date of birth. There he pops.
There he is.
Yep. All the fucking warrants start popping up. I'm like, yeah. I come up. I'm like, hey, I like came out of the car. We had a few guys on scene, right? I was like, I called his real name. He's like, ah, fuck, you got me. I'm like, yeah, bro, we ain't that stupid. Right? And he was cool. And the girlfriend was lying. So it's even better. So the girlfriend was lying about him. And I told her, because in New Jersey, we could charge you with hindering the apprehension of another.
Okay.
So I said to her, this is a game that I play. I said, listen, young lady, you're going to find yourself, I'm good at this game. You're going to find yourself going to jail if you lie about his name. So if you tell me a name and it's not him, and you, I can prove. So I start developing like their relationship, how long she's been dating. They're dating a long time, 3-4 years. She gives me the fake name too. She subscribes to it. I put him in the car. Then I cuff her and she's like, for what? I'm like, I warned you.
Right. So
anyway, let's go back into Santana. Maybe we can go over some of the facts of Santana. What happened? You could explain it a little bit.
Okay. So it's been a while since I read it, but if I'm not mistaken, she was Miss Santana was her name. Yeah. She was a suspect in a drug trafficking case, drug dealing.
So they were drug dealing hand to hands outside, and they saw currency exchange, right?
Right, and they moved in to arrest her. As the officers were walking up her front steps, she's standing in the door. They tell her she's under arrest, and she flees back inside the house. She only gets a few steps before they tackle her to the ground, or she falls down or whatever. And she's arrested right there. And there's also drugs found or money. Maybe it was the money was found right there next to her when she fell down. But they're clearly inside the house now. And they had no warrant to arrest her. They had probable cause, but no warrant. And her contention was the arrest, the entry into her home to arrest her was illegal. Therefore, the drugs or money, whatever was found, should be suppressed. She's saying that was the discovered as the product of an illegal entry. So the Supreme Court had to address the hot pursuit exception to the warrant requirement, and first had to figure out whether she was in public or not, because we already knew that a hot pursuit that began an arrest that begins in a public area and a person flees into a house, the police can pursue that person if definitely if it's a felony offense or if there's also some kind of exigency associated. We already knew that prior to Santana. The issue with Santana was, well, she's in the threshold of her door as they're approaching the
standing on the transition, essentially.
Standing right. Yeah, she's literally right on that transition
point. Her feet are on the metal part of the door frame.
So the question is she in public? Because if she is, the hot pursuit doctrine clearly allows the entry. But if she's in a house, then the police would have needed a warrant or some kind of exigent circumstances to make that entry. And the court ultimately held she was in public because she was standing on that threshold, door wide open, completely in view of the people outside. So they didn't need a warrant to make the entry once she fled into the house. So it's probably the world's shortest hot pursuit. I mean, she didn't get very far, but it was a hot pursuit nonetheless.
I think in a lot of drug dealing cases, if you can correct me if I'm wrong, we'll see a lot of that inherent exigency because of the drug deal, because of those items being there on scene. There's a concern that they might be destroyed once we secured a warrant, how fast we could secure a warrant. Right. Is that often an argument by the police?
Yeah. Destruction of evidence is probably, I would think, one of the most frequently invoked exigent circumstances when it comes to home entry. If the people inside are aware that the police are outside, and that certainly, and the police are aware there's drugs inside, there certainly could give rise to an exigent circumstance that if we leave to go get a warrant, by the time we return, it's certainly a strong possibility the drugs would be either destroyed or lost. But, you know, knowing there's drugs inside of a house doesn't create the exigent circumstance. We also have to have a reason to believe they actually will be destroyed. And that typically requires there to be other people in the house. And those other people need to be aware the police are outside the house.
The thing that you're talking about here, I think a lot of cops don't realize what they're doing, is called police created exigencies.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So you can't just hypothesize what could happen. And people will actually say things back in the videos that I do on these social media platforms. Well, like, does it mean the drugs couldn't get destroyed? No, nobody's saying that. The point is, yes, I get that there is some, you know, common sense to be interjected into some of these scenarios from a law enforcement officer's perspective. But we also have to consider the U.S. Constitution and the rulings from the Supreme Court of the United States, that you can't just say, well, the reason we did it is because they could have destroyed the drugs. You'd have to cite some action that led you to believe they were going to destroy the drugs if you didn't take immediate action at that point.
Right. And a quote that I've been using for years, and I did not come up with it. I wish I did, but it's very straightforward and it makes sense. To enter a house, you need probable cause. Okay. And probable cause deals with probabilities, not possibilities. Yes, it's possible the drugs could be destroyed. But in order to rightfully have probable cause, you have to have a reason to believe they actually will be destroyed. Like they're aware you're outside, and they're also aware there's drugs in the house, those kinds of things. But possibility of something happening is not purely speculating as to what could happen is not sufficient under for Fourth Amendment purposes.
We've talked about in the past now. That's warrantless entries into a home. We've talked about, we don't got to go over too much of it today, Peyton v. New York, Stiegel versus the United States. We will stay away from Stiegel for the moment. We'll just briefly touch him. Peyton says.
Yeah. So, well, the first part of Peyton was that we can't make warrantless entry to arrest for a felony. So that the case, that was the main part of the case, was can the police enter a house without any kind of warrant to arrest a felon inside the house? And the Supreme Court said, not without exigent circumstances. You can't make a warrantless entry to arrest someone inside the house, even if it's for a felony, unless you have an exigent circumstance. But then later on in the case, the court talked about an arrest warrant serving as the authority to enter the arrestee's home when you have a reason to believe they're there. And that's over the years, Peyton has become more important for that proposition than the you can't make a warrantless arrest for a routine felony.
And then Stiegold versus the United States talked about the third party home.
The third party, where the third party being the an uninvolved person. So the arrestee or the person to be arrested is in the home of somebody else, a third party, not their own home. And Stiegold tells us that arrest warrant that will let us go into the arrestee's house, that doesn't adequately protect the third party's interest in their own house. That entry requires a search warrant, consent, or exigency in order to protect the third party's Fourth Amendment interest.
I think the next thing I'm going to say is a little bit of a mind-blowing experience here because, you know, you all depend on us to come up with these theoretical explanations based on what we've read in case law. And I've been reading a lot of home entry case law recently. So we have a case outside of New Jersey. And let me just start with this. In New Jersey, one of our charges for running from the police is called obstruction by flight. Here, it's a fourth degree crime, so it's a felony offense. With that being said, we know the hot pursuit doctrine allows police officers to follow a suspect into their home for a felony offense that initiated in public. We can go from public into the private house, correct?
Correct.
So hypothetically speaking, even if you had a misdemeanor offense in public, but the person obstructed by flight met the criteria in the state of New Jersey and now became a felony offense, would that now allow you to enter into the home by that flight?
Yeah, because now I have probable cause to arrest for both offenses. So you're saying the flight is a felony?
Yes.
If I have probable cause to arrest for... Okay.
To arrest. It doesn't matter what the underlying offense is.
Right.
So one of the things... Again, I'm sorry.
No, you're right. So that now you have two crimes that you're arresting them for, one misdemeanor and one felony. And so, yeah, you can pursue them inside the house.
Now, if people are going to employ this, my suggestion is to read up a little about the case law regarding your obstruction by flight or your fleeing cases, because there might be triggering events that have to occur in order for you to prove this was an obstruction by flight. So maybe something like yelling, stop police, you're under arrest. I've seen a lot of language in cases like that that actually are the important parts. I don't know what the word I'm looking for is, chain of events.
Yeah, so I'm assuming that a statute like that requires that they be fleeing from an arrest, and they arrest, the notice to arrest has to be communicated to the person in some regard. That's an element of the crime. Having probable cause to arrest the person, communicating that intent to arrest, and then them fleeing from that arrest. That sounds to me like those are elements of that offense. And without those elements have to occur before you have that authority to make a warrantless entry into a house.
You know, it's interesting. I just taught in Illinois last week, a week before today in Homestead. And Illinois follows Brenlin v. California. They say lawful order. You get pulled over, you're stuck in a car. But we can't charge somebody with resisting arrest, which is essentially what their charge is when somebody gets out of the car and starts fleeing, unless we communicate to them that they are lawfully detained to start, which I think makes a ton of sense. And I try to explain that in class about verbal commands, physical touch, what it means. It's not, Brenlin doesn't discuss what statute it violates. It's the lawful order that will then, if they deny that or ignore that lawful order, might begin to violate other statutes right in your state.
Yeah. Yeah. Brenlin and Johnson were just answering the Fourth Amendment question. Are the passengers free to leave as a matter of Fourth Amendment law? And the answer is no. Now, what do you commit a crime when you leave somewhere you're not allowed to be not allowed to leave under the Fourth Amendment? That's a question for state law, state statutory law. Some states it is, some states it's not. Virginia, it's not. I can tell you it's not by itself opening the door and walking away. It's not a crime, although you're not allowed to do that.
So let's change it up a little bit so people can really understand this. You open up the door, you start to walk away. The police officer yells and goes, "Hey, get back in the car." And they listen. No crime has been broken. You know, there's Correct. Been no offense been committed.
Correct.
Now we say, "Hey, get back in the car." And the guy starts to run and gives you the middle finger. Now we have some kind of crime.
You certainly could have that. That could be an obstruction of justice. You know, if it's diverting my attention from addressing the other legal matter that I'm there for, which is the traffic stop, it certainly could be an obstruction, or some states have hindering.
Each state's got their own offense name. They have interference. Everybody's got the different.
Yeah, but it's the same principle, basically.
Now, the reason I bring this up is because we have a case in New Jersey. When Jersey follows when it comes to home entries with warrants in their hand. New Jersey follows the U.S. Supreme Court. And this is going to be universal for everybody, but I want to give you guys some thought on this. We follow Peyton v. New York. We follow Stegall versus the United States, where we can't go and make entry into a third-party home. However, why I've led up to this point is we have a case where the police have a warrant for a guy. They pull up. They see him. He starts to run. They yell, stop, whatever, you're under arrest. And he runs into his grandmother's house where he doesn't live. They run into the grandmother's house, arrest him, and then they see items in plain view once inside the house. And we'll come back to plain view in a little bit. So they collect all the plain view items. And he came to court. And he said, the cops can't follow me into a third party home to make a warrantless arrest, according to the Stegall versus the United States. And the New Jersey court said, you're right, they can't. But when you fled from them, you now trigger the hot pursuit doctrine under that fourth degree crime that you've committed. So they had every right to run into anybody's home you ran into and arrest you. So it's a good piece of law to know, but it depends on your state.
Yeah, that's why what you said is important. The sequence of events are important. You know, when did he go inside the house? Did he go inside after you told him he was under arrest? Was he attempting to avoid capture, or did he just want you drove up as he was walking inside his house? You know, just
different story.
To a different story, right? Yeah, that's not a hot pursuit.
So we're actually the warrant is almost moot and irrelevant at this point. Now we have in some sense for the entry into the home. We're not talking about the warrant anymore. Now we're talking about a fourth degree crime, or a fourth degree felony, whatever you want to call it,
right.
And a flight and into a house. Now you're in the hot pursuit doctrine. So you got to know how you're applying these. You know, it's interesting, Zach. I think about this stuff and I'm like, man, this is why you got to know this shit and run these scenarios through your head, because what are we going to do at this moment?
Yeah, these are the kind of things you need to know the answer to as they're occurring. You know, and there aren't a lot of these things where you have to know right now what you can and can't do. Most of these legal issues that we talk about, you do have a few moments at least to kind of slow down, pause, collect your thoughts and think about, you know, what we're going to do. But, you know, in a situation like this, you're in a hot pursuit and you're coming up on a house and you need to know if you can go through that front door or not. You know, that's something you need to know pretty quickly. You don't have time to make a phone call or sit down and, you know, sketch out your action plan. You got to know these things.
Yeah. You know what? Honestly, there's probably 25 things that you got to try to memorize as a cop for these situations of what can we do. And, you know, I the reason you got to know this stuff is because when you take that action, and you could almost guarantee that you're going to have backlash from command staff or the public in some sense filing a complaint against you, that you can justify the actions you took comfortably. And that's the idea of the case law, is like, hey, you can't do that. Yeah, here I can. Here, it's right here. It says it right here.
Right.
It's wild how people get punished as police officers for actually following the law when they're trying to explain it to a command staff member that has no fucking idea what the law says.
Yeah, I would think if I was in a command level position where you're reviewing these things, you should be, you know, these are things that should be reviewed, by the way. These aren't, you know, we enter somebody's house without a warrant. You know, someone in the chain of command probably should just do some follow up to make sure we're doing everything correctly. But, you know, if you're the decision maker in your agency where you're making a decision on discipline or policy implications, you know, you need to have an open mind, be willing to learn. And because you got to get it right. If we're going to be disciplining an officer for violating somebody's constitutional rights, there needs to, in fact, be a violation of someone's constitutional rights.
It breaks my heart when I hear men and women who suffer at the hands of these administrators who don't like the way things feel. Mm-hmm. This is not a job for comfort. This is a job about following the Constitution and the laws set forth by your state and what's right and what's wrong. It's never going to feel comfortable. You know, some of the things that we do seem very uncomfortable, but the fact of the matter is as long as you're following the Constitution, we got to get this job done.
Right. Yeah. The Constitution is the pathway that sets the guardrails for what we can and can't do. That's what it boils down to. And you know, a lot of police work doesn't look pretty. It's by definition not pretty. I mean, just use of force is a perfect example. Use of force can never look pretty. I mean, but it's a necessary component of policing. So is barging into somebody's house in some cases without a warrant. It's a necessary function of policing. Now we just got to make sure we're following the rules when we do that.
The crazy thing is a majority. When I say majority, I'm talking about in excess of 99% don't even know what the rules are. That's terrifying. I don't even know all the rules, to be quite honest with you. I've read them. I have to get fresh on them. I stay in my lane. But there are rules. People are like, hey, do you do juvenile law? And I'm like, no. Where do I find that? I'm like, I don't know. Right? Like, I don't even know what juvenile law and procedure is. That's a whole big thing. It's not the rules that I'm teaching out here. I can tell you how not to violate juveniles' constitutional rights. Right. I could say a little about Miranda and things like that here in the state of New Jersey, what some of the rules are with that, because there's case law on it. But, you know, I don't know, like, how long can you hold a juvenile before you have to contact the judge? Like, that's state-by-state issues.
Yep. It's all statutory. Yep.
You know, it's interesting. I had a guy reach out to me recently, and I didn't have time to respond back because I got to be honest with you. At this stage of the game, I have to pick and choose my battles. And, you know, Zach, we've become like the case law liaisons for the state of the entire country. And it just goes to show you that, like, this is how bad the state of affairs is, that there's almost nobody who you could rely on for proper case law interpretation. As a matter of fact, I have to address a topic today in New Jersey. I'm going to try to do a video before I leave here, because remember that one with the dog sniff case, that Kyle Smart or whatever it was that came out, and they said, like, you know, that the dog prolonged the stop, you have to get a warrant. Now you got prosecutor's office saying you need to go get a fucking warrant now. It's completely wrong. It makes me furious, because now you're telling cops the wrong thing again. Mm-hmm. So you're not qualified to give advice like this. You are misinterpreting the law and the decision that's been made. These people need to really, really collaborate and collectively come down to not being scared and understanding how to explain the ruling in life. That actual ruling that came out, I think it was Kyle Smart, it had no significant relevance to anything from the past or the future. None. It was a proper application of previous case law cited in New Jersey. And people just can't unpack what it meant. And, you know, we got on the phone with somebody that we kind of know a little bit. That person couldn't understand it either.
Yeah, I remember having that conversation. Yeah, it's it happens all the time.
But anyway, I had a guy reach out to me last week, and he said, hey, I'm told in the state of Virginia, and this is great because you're from Virginia and nobody knows Virginia better than you do, that we have to do the trooper two-step. We have to give somebody back their documents and then release them in order to get voluntary consent. And I said, there's no fucking way. And he goes, no, have you read this case out of 21? I go, brother, I don't got time to read it right now. I'm on a plane. I'm going to tell you right now, our fucking number one case law guy is from Virginia. Trust me. Yeah. If this was something that overturned Robinette, we would know. If they departed from Robinette, we would know. There is no doubt in my mind you are misunderstanding it. Well, my command staff says, I go, I know people that read case law and have no idea what it says, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a real thing. People can read it and completely misunderstand it.
Oh, absolutely. No, there's no doubt about that. Because we've talked about this before. There's a skill in reading an opinion, a judicial opinion. There's a skill to it. You have to understand how it's structured and you got to understand some of the procedural components of the case, how the case got to the court that's issuing the opinion in the first place, what issues being presented. Yeah, there's a lot to it. So there are a lot of people who will read a case and not understand what it says or completely misinterpret what it says. But no, as far as Virginia, there is no case that says you have to do this trooper two-step song and dance thing to effectively end a stop in transition to a voluntary contact. There simply isn't.
And that's supported with reasonable suspicion present to prolong the traffic stop, just so we're clear.
Yeah. Yeah. To extend the stop, I need reasonable suspicion, but to end it and try and transition to a voluntary contact before they drive away, I don't have to do the break in contact. I just have to make it appear to a reasonable person that they're free to leave. A reasonable person would think this stop is over. I can decline to participate with the officer, or I can choose to. It's completely my choice. That's the standard.
And that's not what we're not talking about. You know, I told this guy, go, listen, when you have reasonable suspicion to prolong your stop, you don't have to do a trooper two-step to disengage to try to prove or establish voluntary consent. And people always say, well, what do you need? Well, one, you need to know what constitutes voluntary and lawful consent in your state. And then we have to objectively hit those marks and those components to prove that. The only way to do, the best way to do this is what you're communicating to that person. Guy just asked me today, he goes, hey, can somebody in handcuffs give consent? And I said, now, let me start by saying this. I would highly implore all of you to remove handcuffs when getting consent. However, it doesn't mean that you can't get consent of somebody who's handcuffed, right? They're detained, they're in cuffs. I think it's a big component on whether or not it's going to be considered a voluntary consent being handcuffed. It's clear as day. But certainly what you're telling somebody, hey, man, I know you're in cuffs. Here's the reason why. This has nothing to do with me asking you for consent. As a matter of fact, the consent that I'm going to ask from you has no relevance to what's going to go on from this point forward. There's no threat to you saying no to this consent procedure. Before I go with another route, I want you to know that we're seeking to get consent to search from you for this item or whatever it may be, this effect for which you have control over. Understand, you don't have to fucking agree. You know, especially with the handcuffs in place. I want to really overemphasize that the handcuffs are irrelevant. I want to communicate that to you verbally. Your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, being detained, being handcuffed, being locked in a police car, being under arrest, none of those things by themselves invalidate consent. Consent just has to be voluntarily given. Voluntarily just means not the product of undue coercion. We're not making threats. We're not making promises we can't keep. We're not denying access to the bathroom. We're not, threatening to arrest them. We're not using excessive force. We're not putting any undue pressure on them. You can be not free to leave. You can be under arrest. You can be in handcuffs and still give valid consent. Now, with that being said, it's a good idea to explain if somebody's in handcuffs, explain why they're in handcuffs. And the application of the handcuffs has to be lawful. You can illegally handcuff people. We've talked about this before. You can illegally handcuff people during an investigative stop. And if you have someone illegally handcuffed, then yes, the consent you obtain from them is invalid because they shouldn't be in handcuffs in the first place. But yeah, I like the idea if someone is in handcuffs lawfully, explaining to them why they're in handcuffs before we seek consent. That only helps your case, your position, as this being voluntary consent. And consent doesn't have to be given knowingly under the Fourth Amendment, but it does in some states. I believe New Jersey is one of them, right, where you have to tell
knowing, them. Knowing, intelligent, and voluntary.
So they have to know they have the right to refuse. That's not the Fourth Amendment rule, but it is the rule in a fair number of states as a matter of state law.
I recently did some video or language about somebody being in handcuffs and when we're allowed to employ handcuffs during investigative detention. I try to tell people, you just can't use handcuffs every single time. You just can't. It's against a bright line rule of putting handcuffs every time somebody's lawfully detained. And people say, well, what do you mean? I go, well, you have to actually point to some kind of significant safety concern for the most part of why you would handcuff somebody. And some examples might be the officer's outnumbered. The person is violent. It follows a violent crime. There could be a number of reasons why. Now, how would you know when that's permitted? You're going to read case law of when it was permitted and when it wasn't. And we talk about failure to remove those handcuffs once those significant safety concerns diminish. That could roll into an unintended or de facto arrest.
Yeah.
I had a guy recently just today comment and he said, yeah, but that guy could get crazy again. Well, we're back to police created exigencies. If there's a potential for danger still there, well, certainly as long as you articulate and document it, you can keep him in handcuffs. But once, if you're no longer outnumbered, now it's 7-1. There's 3 people on scene. It was after a fight call. Everybody's calmed down. Nobody's giving you a hard time. And there's going to be no intention of probable cause to arrest. We're not moving forward with this. Maybe we're taking a report at this point once we've sorted all the shit out. You can't just leave people in cuffs because there's a potential. It's a police-created exigency. You're in your mind coming up with what could happen.
Right. Handcuffs are the exception, not the rule on investigative stops. Handcuffs are closely associated with someone being arrested. They require special justification during investigative stops, meaning when you're operating only on reasonable suspicion, handcuffs require justification. Safety risk, and I would also include flight risk. The person is a flight risk.
Yeah.
But you have to articulate your belief for that.
For sure. People have to understand these are the rules you have to follow, right? And I get it. Guys are like, well, I work in this tough area. Hey, guess what? You work in a tough area. That's a big factor in whether or not you can use handcuffs. That's something you can consider. No argument here. And by the way, I don't want people second guessing, especially in situations that are dangerous. I'm really not urging you to second guess. Do I have enough? If you feel like you're there, I'm not emphasizing you to violate civil rights. You just might have a hard time articulating it. And I'd rather you try to explain what was going on in this secular, unique situation rather than getting shot in the face. Right. We could take any kind of issues over death any day of the week.
Yeah. And it's not a high burden to overcome. It's just what about this guy in this particular situation gives you a reasonable concern for safety? give us some facts, some factors. That's all we're asking. It's not a high bar. I don't have to have reasonable suspicion that he's a threat. I don't have to have probable. It's not a guaranteed standard. It's just something. Articulate some reason why you believe this guy is a threat.
We have anything else to talk about today, Zach?
We could talk all day long, but I think we've covered a bunch of ground.
This is a good one.
Good ground today. Yeah. Yeah.
We often have a lot of people who ask a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And typically what I see is a trend in the similar question, and then just gives us some kind of stuff to work with for the podcast.
Yeah. I get questions all the time, and they're a lot of them are very similar, but the fact that they're constantly being asked is telling me that these are things we need to keep talking about.
For sure. Yeah. I miss you.
It's been a while. I'm going to have to make a trip up to New Jersey here soon.
Don't you tease me, you son of a bitch.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
I've never been to the house. No.
If it's warm enough, we'll bring you out to our essentially Nitro Circus garage, and you could choose from a number of all-terrain vehicles to go out and be silly in my neighborhood.
I've seen some of the videos.
Yeah. We like to keep it moving. Keep it a little dangerous, the Bonino household.
I can tell.
All right, brother. It's great seeing you.
All right.
And I'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you later. All right, bye.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.